My next guest is David Hong, survived the Stoneman Douglas High School shooting back in February, and you've seen him all over the place since then. He's an activist, not only on gun violence, but also about getting out the vote for younger people and all people. David, thanks for stopping by with us here today. We appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
So, David, walk us through. I know you probably told this story like 10,000 times and you're sick of telling it, but I think for a lot of listeners, you know, and unfortunately we have so many school shootings that we are covering in the news, they honestly start to blend together, which is a horrible state of reality in this country, but they do. So this was a school shooting on Valentine's Day of this year, back on February 14th. Walk us through what the experience was like for you when you first heard what was happening, what you did, and how you ended up getting out of there.
Yeah, sure. I was in my AP environmental science class, and as I was in there, the door was slightly open and there was a gunshot that we heard, and I look at my friend and I say, like, hey, that sounded like a gunshot. And the important thing to note is I was in the building right next to where the shooting was happening, but we could still hear gunshots.
So your campus has a couple different buildings.
Yeah, it's an open campus. Mm-hmm. But I look at my friend and tell him that, and we tell our teacher. She goes and closes the door, but then the fire alarm goes off. So we start walking out, and as I'm walking out, there's like a flood of kids running the opposite way of where I am. And they're like, don't come this way. He's coming this way. I'm like, what the, like,
what's happening? Yeah.
Yeah. And I start following them, kind of following the herd. And I inadvertently ended up running towards where the gunfire was coming from. But luckily there's a janitor that stopped me. And right as he stopped me, a teacher opened up her classroom and got about 60 students in her classroom in a matter of like 20 seconds, I want to say. And as we were in there, like, we very soon realized that this wasn't like an active shooter drill, which is a common thing for a lot of American school children.
Which is crazy to think in and of itself.
Yeah, but I've grown up around it.
Yeah.
Like, I was born a year after Columbine. Like, this is my life. In the same way that I'm sure many listeners, like, that are older had to go through, like atomic bomb.
Yeah,
like,
duck
training.
And cover, yeah.
It's like that, but... Like, this isn't a massive geopolitical issue, right? This is something we can solve. This is something that is easily solvable, and it's within America. But going back to what happened is, as I was in there, and we found out, like, on Twitter that there was this, like, shooting going on, and we were looking at the aerial footage of our school. I took my phone out and started recording and interviewing people, not knowing whether or not we were going to die, because I figured if our souls were left behind, hopefully our voices could carry on to create some kind of change so that this wouldn't happen anymore, because this isn't acceptable in any community, not just in schools, but anywhere where children have to fear violence, period. Luckily, I made it out that day, but 17 other people didn't, and I felt an immediate responsibility for those that couldn't speak at the time, like my sister, who had lost 4 friends that day, to go out and speak for them so that this wouldn't just be, sadly, like, I hate saying this, but like another... school shooting,
right?
Story.
Where you get the typical interviews that you expect to get from people and parents, and then everyone moves on 2 days later.
Yeah, and my mission was to immediately point out what's causing these issues, and that's organizations like the NRA blocking things like background checks. When the NRA blocks things like background checks, I want to make one thing very clear. When you're an organization that actively lobbies to block background checks for gun sales, you are not an organization that stands for gun safety, period.
So it was a pretty immediate turn to advocacy. I mean, do you even call it, do you consider it advocacy, or do you consider it a fight just for what you feel is a basic thing that should be enforced?
I think it's the way I see myself and my friends at this point is like the same way that there are people that were like when motor vehicle accidents cost thousands and thousands of lives, and they still do in America, but even more so than they do now. And people went out and like tried talking to the car manufacturers to make cars safer. They kept going back saying again and again, like, we're just going to focus on human behavior and try making sure everybody's a safe driver, because cars don't kill people, people kill people.
So you're making the discussion that, oh, it's only mental effects that will do this. As school kids were bullied, we got to stop the bullying, which is a whole separate argument. Yeah. But
the United States has the same rate of bullying as most more developed countries. You have the same rate of mental health issues. And actually, what really scares me is when people talk about mental health, they trick people into thinking that every mentally ill person is violent, and they're not. More often than not, people that are mentally ill are victims of violence, and we need to recognize that. We need to recognize that we have the same rates of bullying as most more developed countries. Same rates of mental health illness, and the one thing that's different is the incredibly easy accessibility to firearms in this country for children and anyone else, where there are more guns than people.
Yeah, it's more than 350 million guns, I believe, for 330 million people here in the United States. So My question to you is, what sort of things do you are you big on advocating for specific things and that you're okay with responsible gun ownership? Or are you looking to start a movement that goes and abolishes the Second Amendment at some point and that will free up the courts to make decisions that allow these legislative decisions to go through? Where do you stand on what sorts of things you want done?
Yeah, no, I'm not trying to abolish the Second Amendment. The only thing that I'm trying to abolish is the fear that millions of children and Americans have every day about being taken by violence in their communities. That's the only thing that I'm trying to get rid of.
What sort of ways can we do that?
We can do that with extremist protection orders that disarm domestic abusers and people that are at risk themselves and others through due process. So, for example, if the shooter at our school was reported through this process and we had that law in place, he could have been his family or anybody else around him could have reported him and he would have been taken to court. And for 72 hours, he would have the ability to go out and argue for his right to bear arms and prove that he's not a danger to himself or others. It's basically like a temporary restraining order, but for guns. And that's major. We've disarmed over 500 people that are a major risk to themselves and others in Florida since we enacted that law. And that doesn't hurt law-abiding gun owners. One important thing to recognize, though, is that Americans agree on this issue so much more than we think we do. It's just because a vocal minority think that we don't need background checks. I've met people that even think that we need vending machines on every street corner with guns to make people safer, and that's absurd. When people talk about self-defense, oftentimes the odds of you being killed if you're trying to use a gun in self-defense when somebody's breaking in are significantly higher than if you weren't using a firearm, because public polling shows again and again and again that when somebody's breaking into your house, for example, their number one hope, like, they've polled criminals to see what their actual motives are. They don't want to hurt people most of the time when they're breaking into your house if it's just property crime, because it's driven by economics. They just want to steal stuff and sell it so that they can make money. The number one reason why criminals have firearms when they are breaking into a house in this specific instance is because they feel they need it for self-protection in case that person is armed. And what's interesting is the odds of you being killed in that specific situation is significantly higher if you have a firearm in your house and that person that's breaking in has a firearm too, because it can even be used against you.
Do you feel like the gun rights issue, gun control issues, are like many of the issues are today, where we look for like such black and whites and we try to move everyone to such extremes, and that the real conversations, you've had people calling you as part of a giant conspiracy, a crisis actor, that sort of stuff. I feel like the majority of us Americans, if we can dull out that noise on the right and on the left, some real conversations can be had and some progress can be made.
Yeah, this isn't a partisan issue. Just like in the same way that people that advocated for car safety weren't anti-car or pro-car. Right. I'm not pro-gun or anti-gun. I'm pro-children and Americans and human beings not dying from senseless gun violence that's preventable.
Do you go state by state, city by city, talking with leaders? Are lawmakers still answering your calls? Mm-hmm. And because I know in the first few weeks, there was a certain energy after this school shooting that we didn't see, a momentum forward politically. Oh. And I think it's because of you and your classmates not shutting up, not allowing yourselves to be shut up, and continuing to take interview requests and being on the front lines of this thing and saying, we want this to be the last one. Has that momentum fizzled? Has that momentum gained strength?
No, it's definitely gained strength. It's just that people... I think a lot of time in American society, when children, like in any movement, when people start acting up, the fact that I'm here right now talking to you proves that we haven't lost that momentum. That momentum has become normalized in our country, where people are standing up to make this change. We've seen over 60 gun laws passed since the shooting at our school at the state level, and that's major. We've seen ERPO enacted in over 10 states since the shooting at our school, and that's major. And ERPO is extremist protection orders, red flag laws.
I'm glad you clarified, because I had no idea, but yeah. I was nodding along, yes.
Yeah, and that's that system taking guns away from people that are at risk themselves and others through due process. I think, honestly, one thing, since we're here in Chicago, like, people often talk about how Chicago has strict gun laws. One, they have some strict gun laws, but not nearly as strict as they could be, for one. And secondly, when they talk about, like, even if they did have the strictest gun laws, because we don't have federal legislation, like a federal one gun per month policy, except for bona fide gun collectors, so essentially, you're able to go into Indiana easily and buy
miles
several
away.
Guns.
Wisconsin, Iowa, Michigan,
exactly.
They're all close, yeah.
And a federal one gun per month policy, except for bona fide gun collectors, would end a major amount of that, because a majority of the guns that are bought in this country and used in crimes are bought legally. So when people talk about lawful gun owners, the shooter at our school was a law-abiding gun owner that legally bought and obtained his weapon.
Do you find it difficult when you talk about these specifics? Because I can't imagine the amount of research you had to do and quickly to get up to speed on these sorts of things when you're getting questions from people. But so you come with these specifics. Do you think that some of it gets lost in the minutia of the political atmosphere in terms of how much money the NRA is donating to lawmakers? Or do you feel like having these specific things, these whatever it might be, 5, 10, whatever they are a real way that people can kind of chew on it and actually deliver results?
So the way I see it is like the statistics behind the like what we advocate for, which isn't pro Second Amendment or anti Second Amendment, it's pro saving lives. Period. When we advocate for that, I kind of see that as the logic behind it. But what really changes people's minds is personal stories. So when I go out there and speak to counter protesters that are shouting my name, that are armed with AR-15s at events when we're in Texas, for example, and I go out there and speak to them, saying any of those statistics I just said doesn't change their mind. But when I talk to them about like personal examples of self-defense gun use, for example, when people talk about self-defense gun use, one instance that I bring up is the hundreds of children that are killed every year by their parents because they're accidentally mistaken for an intruder. One example of that is actually in Texas, and it was about a couple of years ago where there was a 7-year-old girl hiding in a closet waiting late at night to like surprise her father when he came home from work. Mm-hmm. And he had a gun for self-defense and conceal. He basically had all the proper permitting to have that gun. When he came home, his daughter jumped out and surprised him, and he shot and killed her. And she died in his arms, and the last words she said to him were, "Daddy, I love you." There are thousands of stories like that across the country that you don't hear people talking about. Right?
So have you... So when you say you're someone, a protester shouting your name with an AR-15 in Texas, I can't imagine the thoughts going through your head. Have you had conversations though with people like that, and you've been able to change their minds? Can we do that in this country?
Yeah, this is not a right or left issue. This is an issue of human lives and whether or not we're going to actually enact laws that allow people to practice the right to bear arms, but also allow people to practice the right to live, simply. And we find that we do agree on a lot more than we think we do, than we think we don't. And when we're talking about disarming domestic abusers, if they're not a domestic abuser, they're not going to be disarmed, period. If you're a law-abiding gun owner that isn't a risk to yourselves or others, you have nothing to worry about, period. Right.
Mm-hmm.
And we find that we agree on a majority of our points. You know, I've gone from people that wanted to initially like kill me or shoot me, that were shouting my name, to them crying and hugging me at the end because I explained that I'm not trying to take your guns away unless you're a terrorist or you're somebody that's going to kill themselves, for example. But I simply just don't want children to die in school,
David,
in their communities.
Right. You're talking at Chicago Ideas Week. We're going to take a quick commercial break and you're going to chat about that after that. Okay. All right, we're going to have more with David Hogg here on 720 WGN. Continuing our conversation here with David Hogg. David, you've got a speech tonight. You're at Chicago Ideas Week tonight at Harris Theater at 7 o'clock, right?
Yep.
And you're going to, the discussion's called Raising Your Hand, What Leadership Looks Like in 2018. So what does leadership look like? I'm older than you. You're 18. I'm in my 30s, but we're in similar technological generations in that so many of my friends they're really geared up for the midterm elections, and that takes them to post things on Facebook and post things on Twitter and Instagram, which go a certain distance. But it doesn't get us anywhere where we actually need to go. I mean, obviously voting is one of the most important things. So what does leadership look like in 2018? How do we get young people, whatever party they're a part of, and old people motivated to act in this time?
I think it's a unifying force that you have to bring with a unifying message. Like what we talk about when we advocate for gun safety and gun violence prevention, it's about children not dying. How are you going to say that children should continue dying? Period. Right. And it's about creating a unifying message. And I think that we're starting to see this a lot in America right now. I think in America, when we see like times where our political leadership, for example, drive a lot of divisiveness just with the decisions that they make, not just the president, but Congress and others. When we see that, we see these movements come along. And I think that's what we're starting to see is when the American public doesn't see that leader, like that unifying force reflected in our elected officials, we become that unifying force together. So I truly do think there's going to be a massive surge in young people voting on both sides come November 6th, which is the midterm elections.
So, when you're talking with someone who vehemently disagrees with you, first of all, if they're talking with you, that's a good thing because usually they're probably just shouting insults at you or texting our text line here. How do you summon the strength, I guess you could say, to try and engage civilly with someone? Because we talk about civility right now in our political discourse. How do you get over the, this guy hates me and does not want to talk to me, and actually have a conversation?
It's understanding that a lot of hatred is a result of fear, and hatred is our defense mechanism against that fear. And the source of that fear is not being knowledgeable about what, like, somebody actually advocates for. So half my job is simply going out and re-educating people on what I actually stand for, not what the media says I stand for. Because it's just to put an example, if they can say that David Hogg wants to take all your guns away, then they make a lot more money than if David Hogg doesn't want kids to die in school, mm-hmm. period. I don't want to take anyone's guns away, period. But what I do want to do is I want to make sure that nobody has to live with gun violence in America, no matter their zip code or the number of figures that they make. And I want to make this country and the world a safer place with my friends, so that no other person that follows our generation will have to go through an active shooter drill or have to worry about going to school that they're going to be shot or robbed, right?
So I think a lot of people take gun rights and then they try and extrapolate onto other issues, because we're in this discourse right now where we're all lumped together on one side or the other. Obviously, if you ever wanted to venture into politics, you'd have to discuss all issues at hand, left or right. Do you ever want to enter politics? I mean, you're 18 now, can't run for Congress for another 7 years or so. Is that something you'd ever be interested in?
Yeah, I think it might be, but I don't know, because I've seen the changes that, like, looking at Washington from the inside and then being thrown into the middle of the political machine that is Capitol Hill, you get to see a lot of how everything actually works. And it's quite frankly disgusting,
right,
on a lot of levels. And it's really disturbing to see that. And if you're able to shine, I feel like if I'm not an elected official, I can shine the light on that constantly and not be part of that system, because I can fix it from the outside. Right.
So we're eight months and a day since the shooting. I mean, your life has been turned completely upside down. Have you even had a chance to, like, reflect on that? Or has it been such a whirlwind that maybe it won't be for years later? Do you realize just how different David Hogg's life is before February 14th and after?
Yeah, I haven't had time to reflect on it, and I'm not going to reflect on it until we actually fix this issue, which may take several decades. You know, it's not an easy fight, but this is one that is backed by people that have lost children, friends, significant others, and people that never should have died, period. And that's how I know we're going to win, because we will win using positivity, and we will win by showing what's actually driving this issue and showing the fact that most Americans agree on our policy points that we advocate for.
David Hogg, the co-founder of March for Our Lives, in town for Chicago Ideas Week. The discussion is called Raising Your Hand, What Leadership Looks Like in 2018. It's tonight at the Harris Theater at 7 o'clock. David, thanks for joining us, okay?
Thanks for having me.